Hi, everybody. My name is Kevin. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Kevin.
Brian, thank you for having me. I already forgot your name. I can remember Amir's name, but I can't remember. Mark. Mark, thanks for having me. I was a 10-minute speaker here about 2 years ago, and my friend Mike said, if you're any good, they'll call you. And like, Mike, they never called me. A couple weeks ago, I had a call from Kelly Lopez, and she's like, Mike Dixon says you're an amazing speaker. And I told Kelly, Mike Dixon is a chronic liar. So, if you don't like my pitch tonight, I'll take responsibility. So anyway, I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 15, 1986. My home group is Stepping Stones Alano, 7 p.m. Sunday night meeting. Tonight, your Jason is there speaking. So, kind of like we traded speakers. I come from a sober alcoholic home. So if knowledge of alcoholism would have kept me from drinking like I did, it would have worked. I saw a parent, and it was scary as a teenager. I saw a parent who was drunk in the swimming pool, and I had another parent, my father, who was a member of the New York City Police Department, tell me one day, Kevin, watch your mother's drinking. Okay, and he comes home and she's in bed and she's out, and I think I'm in trouble. But naturally, I was not. Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things about doing panels with my friend Hugo here is he talks about his dad having a drug problem, and then I talk about my dad being in law enforcement, and I get the look from the crowd, you know, in those rehabs. Yeah. I didn't choose his trade. You know what? I was a rotten kid from the beginning. You know, as I'm getting older, I realize what a rotten kid I was. I mean, I used to steal money from my mother and buy my friends candy just to make friends. And I was the type of kid, I could go into a 7-Eleven and I could steal right in front of the clerk watching me. You know, and it's like, am I hired? I mean, do you guys need a thief? Here's the thing. I realized what a rotten person I was growing up. Alcoholism had nothing to do with it. Like I said, I come from a sober home. Right out of the gate, I turned 18 years old and it was legal. I went and got my first legal drink at the bar across the street. That might have been one or two times I drank and had a beer, and that was it. What alcohol did for me is it shut this off. Just took that edge off. I mean, in my high school year, I'm failing. I'm failing all my classes, and I had just started drinking. And I had the golden card. I had a driver's license. Okay, and most people in my high school class did not have a driver's license. And so I would lend it out. And I was making friends lending my driver's license out. In fact, I enlisted in the Navy, and to this day, I don't know who still has my driver's license, you know. But here's the thing. I'm making friends. I'm getting in that fast crowd. And like I said, drinking was doing for me what I needed to do. Now, I am number two of six kids. And I have an older brother, and he was very much into the Catholic religion. His idea is drinking is two beers, and I'm done. So first time my brother gets drunk, my parents are very nurturing. They woke me up. They told me, Kevin, go take care of Tom's catechism class and watch your language. You know, and because I had no desire to get involved with organized religion or God or anything. I didn't equate a good time with God. And when my turn to get drunk and have that hangover, it was totally different atmosphere. I don't know if it was the times or my father just saw it in me. He's like, you two, you're going to go wash the windows of the house, and you're doing it outside, which was my job. It's like, if you're going to get sick there. What I didn't realize is my mother was dying of cancer. You know, and this is the difference between me and my older brother. He was covertly defiant. I'm overtly defiant. I will come home from getting stoned and sit with my dying mother. Okay? Okay. He will defy my parents and do nothing. And so I got a bit of a pass on being a failure in school because of what was going on at home. You know, and like one of the things I love about doing panels is I realize more about myself as I talk to those inmates in jail. One of the things I didn't realize what a lowlife I was is after my mom passed, you know, my father asked us, would you kids like a little memento piece of jewelry? I'm like, no, I want what's in the medicine chest. And I remember my Uncle Joe, who was a hero of mine, throwing that stuff down the drain, and everybody looking at me, Kevin, what is wrong with you? Like, you just threw away my inheritance. So here it is, like, she only gone a week or two, and I'm looking to get a nice buzz. You know, my drinking did not last long after high school. My father losing his wife was a big thing. She left him with six kids, and he was a little crazy. He was a little inattentive to my behavior. And there came a point sometime, I guess I was out of high school a couple of months, he became very attentive to my behavior. Because what I was doing was, I would leave the house at 7 p.m., okay? Go get me a six-pack of beer, pack of cigarettes, hang out with the lightweights till 10, and then the party goes on till from 10 o'clock to 2 in the morning. And I'm having hangovers, I'm waiting for things to happen. Here's the thing, I was trained as an electrician, yet I wouldn't look for a job. You know, yeah, it'll work out someday. Yeah, one of these days, I'll get that going. You know, and what happened was, some dude came home from the Navy and they had a great party when he got off boot camp, and I began to think, you know, maybe I should enlist in the military. You know, and like, my father bought the book, you know, the pretest, but here, study this, you know, and you want to get in, the GI Bill's ending. He was encouraging me to leave, you know, and just like Bill Wilson taking his law exam, I missed the points for the school I wanted because I was out drinking all night. I remember my father yelling at me and, you know, go to bed, you have a test in the morning. And like, the Navy took me anyway. I mean, even hungover and just trying to get through the test, they took me anyway. I ended up in a rating that I absolutely loved. But here's the thing, guys. I remember the night I told my father I was enlisting, and these were his words to me. Good. Because I can't sleep at night. Because every time I hear an ambulance, I think you're in it. And you're either heading to jail or you're going to get killed. And that was the speech from Dad, you know. And I realized, see, I was never married, never got a family, never did any of that stuff. And I'm like, when I read those 20 questions, I'm like, my family wasn't infected. Absolutely not. You know, today I realized, yes. You know, and today I got to call that father and say, thanks for the good things in life, you know. And he's like, what are you doing with your day today? I'm like, well, I'm going to a speaker meeting at noon and I'm the speaker tonight, you know. And like, that's my life right now. Somehow he's not excited about that, and I'm fine with that. Like, if I told him I was going out for a couple of beers, now, you know, now I get a reaction that I don't want. Well, I did very well in the Navy because somehow I'm a good worker, you know. And for about 2 years, I got away with stuff. You know, a big book talks about the drinking life is the only normal life for the alcoholic. And I literally believe deep down in my soul that us drinkers who are really special workers should be able to sleep in an hour later than most people. You know, Navy wasn't down on that. But here's what happened to me. I don't like paying the price. So after 2 years into my enlistment, my friend from New York came down to Virginia for a visit, and within a 24-hour period, I found myself behind bars, once on the military base and one within Newport News, Virginia. And now I got to pay the price. And here's the thing. Junior officers usually interview you before you see the captain. And these guys love to hear the stories. What did you do, Darcy? You know, and I tell them, you know, it seemed like a normal life to me. You know, I remember being in front of the captain, and my supervisor said, he is the best sailor we have in our division. And then the captain read what I said. He couldn't even repeat what I had said to that cop. I mean, it was unrepeatable in this room and out. And the captain's like, I don't know what I got here. Okay, one minute I got somebody who's so dependable, such a good worker, but I can't cut you loose. I can't give you a break. And he shook his head. And he restricted me to the boat for 22 days and took some money. And I remember talking to the leading petty officer. I said, you know, he should have given me a break. My uniform was impeccable. He's like, doesn't matter about your uniform, it's your behavior. Well, one of the things I've learned about my behavior is, and one of my character defects, is I can win your confidence and then screw you over immediately. And like, not on purpose. I mean, I got to the point in the Navy where I drove the captain's boat, which is pretty good standing. And one night I went out and hit Leanne, and I got so drunk I couldn't get out of bed. I told him, write me up, even if the executive office this evening, write me up, I can't move. Now, 2 days later I crashed the captain's boat. I was angry, I hit the gas and put it up on a rock. You know, and I heard a speaker talk about that's alcoholism. And what's alcoholism? Like, I am terrified about what I just did. And yet, could one of my friends go over and take pictures so I can show my friends? You know, two different things. And what I was terrified is I didn't want to pay the price. You know, and what I realized today, I hurt several officers' careers. You know, when stuff, sometimes you see on the internet that a captain was relieved of duty due to non-confidence. When a captain's boat gets sunk, you know, and then the first lieutenant, the navigator, and other people, it damaged their careers. You know, I cannot undo that. In fact, when I got to the amend step, all the letters I sent to the ship got returned to me, which was, you know, fine. I did what I had to do. Well, so you got a view of who I am drinking. So enough of that. So here's what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, I've been living in California a couple of years, and again, coming to California was a geographic because I was able to grab onto the coattails of some of my trade school friends who were doing electrical work for 2 years, and get a job with them. And I found a perfect job. I went to work for this contracting firm. This guy was a drinker. And we generally started 7, 8, 9 in the morning and knew we went to lunch and many times never went back. Never went back to work. And I remember them calling me the kid, you know. And I remember when they allowed the kid to go drinking with them, I thought, I've arrived. I can now drink with the bosses, you know. And one night I was just angry at somebody over nothing, and I'm in a company truck, and despite the fact that people caution me not to drive, I'm going to go over and get $40 off this guy. And a car pulls in front of me, and I can't hit the brakes fast enough. So I slam into them, and I do what I have seen my friends do. I roll down the window, and I told them, let's pull over and talk about this, and then I hit the gas and took off. You know, why did I do that? Because that's what my crowd does. I'm going to do what my crowd does. And my friends got away, in my case, I didn't. Okay, best, worst day of my life. I wake up in jail. I got to bring that truck back to that boss. That was a long ride to his house. You know, and I remember waking up horrified in the middle of the night, and I'm like, the only thing I had in my apartment was one of those sparkling jugs of water, and I think I drank the whole thing. And I'm scared because I don't want to go to jail. You know, it was mandatory. The other reason I ran was mandatory 30 days in jail. You know, so I would consider myself fortunate. They lost my blood test, so the drunk driving went away. The company had amazing insurance, so the felony hit and run went away to a simple misdemeanor. I was giving probation, I think maybe 2 years, a fine, and then community service. And I remember when I got sentenced, the judge said, I will never accept a plea like this again for this type of crime. And you'd think I'd have been grateful. I was so angry and upset. How am I going to stay out of trouble for 2 years? I can't stay out of trouble for 20 minutes, you know. I truly, deep down inside, believe I have bad luck. I've since learned that I have bad behavior, which I have to pay the penalty for. And I had this probation officer, Mr. John Hughes. He seemed to be a little bit mentally disturbed. You know, one minute he's happy, how you doing, Kevin? And next minute he's like, what did you say to me? What are you doing? And like, I started playing games, and I wasn't doing my community service, and I was heading back to the judge. I remember I grabbed the public defender, John Moriarty, and I asked him for help. I'd lied through my teeth, but I think he just took pity on me and helped me iron the thing out. So one day, I realize the drinking has to go. And I'm about 2 weeks into this. And just like this big book says, the time will come when I will have no defense over that first drink. And it did. I went down to the probation department, and Mrs. Hughes told me I had to go to AA. I'm willing to do anything but AA. Okay, I've had it with my sober mother and the slogans and this and that, you know, and like, what happens? Somebody offers me a drink and I'm off and running again. And like, the day of my last drink of alcohol, it's a Monday, just like the book says, life's going good for me. I got a job and I'm working for a contractor who wants me there at 6, lets me off at 2:30 and pays me every Monday. And they like me, they like the effort I put in. Things were so hard, I was spending more money getting a cab to work than I was earning. But I kind of think, hey, if I keep going to work, eventually something will break loose. And one morning, I wake up, it's Tuesday morning, should have been at work at 6, and it's 9 o'clock, I'm on my buddy's couch. And my father's voice, of all people, is in my head, says, your life is a mess, and the only reason is you're drinking. I decided to give this AA a try. You know, if you're new, it is scary to walk in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous, because most of the time these people are laughing and you're not sure if they're laughing at you, you know, and it can be a little bit disturbing and unnerving. And I remember walking into San Fernando Hall and I heard that laughter at 5:30, and I'm going into the meeting exactly 5:30 and I'm leaving as soon as it's over. And after a couple of days or weeks of doing this, this guy Sage says hi to me. And then he says, keep coming back. And I think he lived to regret those words, because I asked him to be my sponsor. And what I could do, what I'm good at doing is complaining. I'm not good at taking direction. In fact, I was talking to a newcomer at this meeting this morning, and I realized he's talking and I'm listening. He's not listening yet because he's not ready to listen. He'll listen when he's ready. And what happened to this guy Sage is I drove him nuts. I didn't believe these steps would work for me. I thought this fourth step was going to just ruin my life and I'm going to find out something so horrible about me, even I can't go to AA. And it wasn't to be true. But, you know, Bill Wilson talks about in the 12x12 how we have to be desperate. You know, what made me desperate to finish that portion of the steps is one night I'm just hanging out with this guy Sage. And he looks at me and he says, you're fired. And he used a few choice words we don't use around here. And he says, I'm done with you. All you do is call me and disturb my life. You don't take direction. You know, go find somebody else. And so on Monday, I showed up at his house with my fourth step. And I negotiated with him. I said, Sage, here's the thing. You know everything about me. I've told him stuff I wouldn't put on paper. So I really don't want to start over with somebody else. And so we did my fourth step, and I've been hearing people talk about how wonderful they felt after the fourth step, and I'm like, I do. And Sage looks at me when we're done, he says, okay, you did your fifth step. And I'm like, I don't feel any different. You know, where I really got that relief is that ninth step, where I got to call that father and apologize for my behavior. By the way, this guy was talking to her this morning, he's like, I don't think I'm going to make it. I said, that's okay. I had 7 months before I told anybody. You know, I had no idea I was going to make it. And here's the thing. I have five brothers and sisters, you know, and the horror on their faces, I realized that I put them through. You know, there were times my father would say, I'm going out for the night, watch the kids. And I'm like, kids, I'm going to get cigarettes. I'll be back. And I would stare home from the bar. You know, could have put them in grave danger. And one time I got in a fight with my younger brother and really tried to harm him. You know, and you know, it's been decades since that's happened. A couple of months ago, we were on the phone talking, and I'm like, do you forgive me for that? And here's what he said. He said, I forgive you, but don't ever bring it up again. Which means it still bothers him. We get, you know, but we fix what we can around here. You know, and like, I began to get addicted to that ninth step. If apologizing to you is good, I'll apologize to everybody. And that's where sponsorship is so needed. Like my sponsor Terry said, Kevin, you've done your ninth step. Enough. You move on. Now, I started to get into service, you know, and I call this the AA handoff. You ever have somebody say, hey, I'm working at central office on Sunday, why don't you come down with me? And then you do it for a couple of weeks with them and they're like, hey, can you take this week? You know, and you do that about 2 weeks, and then you're like, hey, I'm not coming back. You got it. Yeah, and I've had it happen to me, and just kind of laugh at it, you know. A couple of years ago, I'm at my Sunday night meeting, and this guy, Greg, comes up to me. He says, Kevin, you sound really good at the podium. How would you like to go on panels? So he got me going on the behavioral health unit, which is the psych ward at Henry Mayo Hospital. And I'm liking it. In fact, there were some nights I left, I'm like, these people got it made. You know, all you got to do is turn in your shoelaces and get your fruit cup and go to bed, the air conditioned. None of the problems I got up here, you know. And pretty soon, someone's talking to me about, why don't you get a jail clearance? And here's what scared me. When you have a jail clearance with the county, you have to do one panel a month, and they consider that 8 hours of service to them. And I'm like, how can I do 8 hours? How can I do one panel a month? Impossible. I have a dog. I have to report to my sponsor. I have this. I have that. What I found out is it's not hard to do one panel a month. It's very easy to be lazy, but it's not hard to do one panel a month. So one night I'm at our regular H&I meeting, and the jail supervisor resigns. And all of a sudden, two retirees who got nothing to do tomorrow look at me. Now, I got to be at work. I got to be in Burbank at 6 a.m., and I'm probably going to work 6 to 6. And I'm like, I can't. They're looking at me like, I cannot do this. Well, I softened up a little, and I called this guy Joseph. I said, Joseph, all right, I can do this, but I'm not taking every panel. I'm not filling any. Understand this. This is what I'm not going to do. And like, next thing you know, I'm filling panels, you know. And what I found is I got to know a different breed of people in this program. I got to know people like Hugo. I got to know my friend Mark. And you know, I did this job for several years. And one day, I called the head of H&I, and I'm like, and here's what the truth of the matter is. I had this friend Mark I met at our men's stag, and Mark was doing my job, and I was taking the credit. You know, and we kind of joked about it, and I said, you know, it's time to turn this over. Rotating responsibilities, and like, you know, I didn't want to let it go, but I should have let it go. You know, here's the beauty of it. Mark took it to a level that I wasn't even interested in doing. I think he had enthusiasm. Him and this guy, Jeremy, both have enthusiasm. They announced H&I every Saturday morning, and they walked up to people personally and said, why don't you get a jail clearance? You know, and they filled all those slots. Where my way of doing it is me trying to fill all this slot, you know. And like, here's the thing about volunteers. We have to treat them like volunteers. One Wednesday, I get a call from this guy, and he says, I'm in New York. I can't do my panel tonight. And I'm thinking, were you kidnapped? I mean, what is wrong with you? But if I said that, I would be doing his panel again next month because I push him away. So I have to learn to be diplomatic in doing these things. You know, one of the things you guys talked about last night was structure. Like, and I like a structured meeting. I'll tolerate an unstructured meeting. In fact, that's why the military was so good for me, because they taught me structure. In fact, I was so structured, everyone thought I was a narc. You know, and don't worry, I proved them wrong. You know, but, you know, sometimes I can get too much into the rules. And one time I had a friend of mine, a very wise guy, said, Kevin, why do we have rules? And I said, I don't know. He says, for our fellowship. Keeps our fellowship going. So I am no longer the jail supervisor. And I forgot. Oh, I got the speaker chair for Stepping Stones Alano on Sunday night. And I really didn't want to give it up. But after, I was doing it for like 4 years, and one of the great thrills about service in AA is the thrill of bringing a really good speaker, you know. And I've been able to, in fact, Stepping Stones also lets me put on their comedy shows, because I was doing comedy years ago and not doing it anymore. I'm lazy, you know, but I know some good comics who put the work in, and every couple of months we put a show together, and it's kind of fun. Other areas of service, they asked me to be the speaker chair for our convention last 2 years, and I had a good time doing it. Now, I don't know if you guys have this, but whenever 30 alcoholics get together to put something together, you got to practice some stuff, you know? And like I'm part, I've had a great weekend. Yesterday, they had Women's Day, and I got to set up the microphone, haul some boxes of stuff in for the ladies, and then leave. And one of my prayers was, is what I hear in the 12 by 12 about our traditions is, God help me to put aside what I think is important for the good of this group. You know, one of the things about service is if you're going to keep score about who's doing what, you're going to make yourself miserable. You know, so sometimes if I'm right, I think about filling in the gaps. Whatever someone's not doing, just fill in the gaps and let's pull it together. And I have a lot of reasons for taking that attitude, because next year somehow they thought I could be the chair next year, and like I think I've screwed enough things up to get it done. You know, there's a friend named Hank years ago. I said, Hank, you are one of the wiser people I know, and Hank said, Kevin, I've made a lot of mistakes getting wisdom. You know, and that's the thing about our program. I can either do it the program's way or learn the hard way. Now, a couple of years ago, a group of us, we decided to go through the 12 steps the way the book says. And when we got to that inventory step, I had a family member who, and here's where they rip you off. Like, just write who you're mad at, you know, nothing else. Who you're mad at, get it on paper. And the reason they do that is now I got to get into the details. And the details of what's really wrong with me. You know, a little bit of a deception. And so I'm writing, mad at this family member, mad at what they did. I cannot see. I don't understand why they're doing what they're doing. They don't mean to do it. I mean, they're not. I don't know why they're doing it, and I'm up at night, and I'm screaming at this person, why did you do this? We're going to lose everything. You know, the drama, we're going to lose everything. You know, and then we're going to both be sitting under a bridge. And what happened is, as I did all the columns, I got nothing. Like, what's going on here? I'm sitting with my friend Jamie, and I'm talking, and I'm running through this, and all of a sudden it hits me. Here's my part in this. I ignored the signs. I tried to make the problem go away. And in me trying to brush over that problem, I made it worse. And what that did, that brought peace under my roof. Peace and serenity, we'd get along. And that clock has not moved, is it right? It's been on, what's that? Oh, it's still good. I thought it was like my GPS. I mean, we got off the freeway and all of a sudden we had no idea where you people were. I should have left this morning. Anyway, there was peace under the roof, peace in the household, and things were starting to heal. And I remember doing what the 10th step said. The 10th step asked me at night, was I kind and loving toward all? And what that kind and loving toward all meant for me that day at that time was calling after I go to my meeting and work a long day, do you need anything? You know, and sometimes that would be three stops. You know, McDonald's, the grocery store, and Kaiser. So sometimes it wasn't easy, but it seemed easy to do. Well, here's what happened. That family member, 7-8 years ago, got cancer and passed away. And I was the caretaker. And I'm not sure if I'd have done a good job or a bad job without those steps, but it certainly made it easier. It certainly made the process easier, and we parted ways on excellent terms, you know. And like, well, here's the thing, the day she died, I called my father, and he knew because he lost a wife. And every day for 30 days, he called me to make sure I was okay. I'm not sure if he was wondering if I was drinking, but I'm sure he was making sure I was okay. And here's the thing, the hand of AA was always there. Every day I got a phone call. In fact, there was this dude named Jim Sanford. He recently passed away, but he would call me every day and say, Kevin, can I do anything for you? And I'm like, I really considered asking him to take the tree off my front lawn and cut it down, just to give him something to do. But you know what I was able to let him do? During her memorial, I was able to have him read something. And I wrote a little bit of the fun things we did in life, you know. And here's one of the things about, I truly believe when people pass away, is they're not here to defend themselves, so don't bring up what they did, you know. And I actually had to tell a family member that. The time to discuss that is done. You know, we're only talking good stuff. Well, a year later, I found my big ego and me being Mr. Hotshot, I found myself in trouble at my job. And you can see, I'm not a young guy, so in your mid-60s looking for a job is not going to be easy. And I remember my boss took me to work, and she said, Kevin, they want to fire you. And we were in a Mexican restaurant, and I swear, the thought of drinking, just like that, powerless over alcohol. But here's what I did. I've been around enough of you people, you solid people who've been through it, who've been through stuff with double-digit sobriety and talked about it and been honest about it, and I knew what to do. And I called this guy from our men's staff, and he gave me some advice I was willing to take. And he said, get a sponsor who's local. Because I had a really good sponsor, but he lived too far away. And he told me, Kevin, put this program first. And all your troubles will evaporate. And they did. And I reached out for a new sponsor. And it just happened, he happened to be in HR. And he said, Kevin, nobody likes a so-and-so. You know, and the other advice I was given is, Kevin, you have not been at that job for 14, 15 years. Tomorrow is your first day at a new job, and you need to prove yourself. And I found a way to make amends to that boss that I had badmouthed. Like, every year we had an inventory, and like, since I was a floater, they'd stick me in a branch, and before going home, I'd call him and say, hey, you need help anywhere else? And I knew he did. He says, if you want, go over there. And I go over there and help him out as best I could. You know, and like a couple years later, some company calls me out of the blue and asks me if I'm interested in moving on, you know, Since, you know, by putting the program first, doing a halfway good job, I've been able to increase my income over a 2-year period, and my income really jumped. I work at a place where today my battle with me is judgmentalism. You know, because no matter where I'm going to go, and you know, what does the book say about praying for others and those people who are really, you know, really, God's still working on them. I don't know verbatim. And they're out there. And I got to be careful of them. And last Sunday I'm at our meeting, and I'm talking about this salesman. And, you know, for whatever reason, I don't like the way he deals with me. And Fran Summers comes up to me and she says to me, Kevin, what do you not like about him? I'm like, well, he's a weasel. Yeah? He's manipulative and sneaky. And here's what Fran tells me. She says, Kevin, I'm going to pray for him. And what Fran was telling me is, I'm going to do what you want, you're not doing. So it was a battle. And like, so here's my goal every day at work. Rings in my head. Kevin, today's your first day at work. You know, and this is if I remember to do it. Today's your first day at work, okay? Those people are there. Pray for those people. God is working on them. And here's the thing. I experienced this year. I have never experienced it, but I have bumped heads with several people in the AA program. And I've been shielded for that for quite a time. And like, sometimes, some of you guys know Mike D. Sometimes I talk to him and see, if I'm angry at Hugo, I'm going to convince everybody that Hugo's wrong. You know? And I can do it. You know? If you're not watching, I can do it. But here's what I've learned to do. You know, somewhere, I don't know the page, but in the big book, in one of the stories, it says, pray for that person for 2 weeks. And pray they get everything I want out of life. Ugh. It's not always easy. So I've done that with a couple of people, you know, and both of those individuals are, I would say, are friends of mine today. In fact, one of them I called last week, last minute, I needed an old-timer quick. You know, one of the old-timers at our meeting had dropped off, and I asked her to do it, and she was gracious enough to step in and do it, you know. And, you know, what I've learned sometimes with my areas of service is back off, okay? I don't have to be the most important person. Just because I brought a good speaker doesn't mean you owe me anything, you know. And then, I think it was last week at our opening Alphacon, we had this really fantastic speaker, and there were no seats. You know, I did. I walked in and I sat right down on the floor, you know, like I own. And Hugo caught it. He says, "Kevin, oh, my wife's not coming. Sit here. Sit here, you idiot." You know? Yeah, and that's the thing. If I'm not doing it right, I got my friends beside me, you know. So today I love doing service. Because yesterday, here's what I got to do. I set up a sound system and I was hauling stuff with the guys, and then we got tossed at it. I went home, it's like, I feel good, you know? And first year on a convention, I'm hanging out with this dude and we're doing security, and I went home and I'm like, I feel amazing today. There's something about doing service. In fact, there's this dude, Pat LaRue. He says there's some magic about doing for others that gets us out of ourselves, you know? And, you know, how do I get out of myself? It can be tough when I'm in there, you know? And that's why I have a good sponsor. I have a sponsor. I don't call him as much. Sometimes I can figure stuff out on my own. Sometimes I check it. And here's what I love, the back and forth. Kevin, you're doing really good there. Kevin, that's the disease, you know? And I remember one time with a conflict with someone, we got to the point, I kept talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. You know, and sometimes your sponsor says, we've already talked about this. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. If I were sane, we wouldn't be talking about this. If I could fix this myself, there would be no conversation. I cannot unload a character defect any more than I can stop myself from drinking. What happens is, in this one case, we got to the point where I'm like, all right, what's the answer? And he's like, let it go. All right, I'm going to somehow... I was able to listen. In fact, if I could do anything right, it would be to keep my mouth shut and my ears open. You know, and I'm about done, guys. Thank you so much for having me. Hopefully we'll find our way home.